Welcome to Between Two Chairs, Demystifying Commercial Real Estate, the podcast that brings you the latest insights and trends on the South Florida commercial real estate market with your hosts, Fernando Arencibia Jr. and Jennifer Wollman. In each episode, we dive into the world of commercial real estate and break down complex concepts to make them accessible for everyone. Whether you're a real estate professional, a curious investor, or just interested in the South Florida market in general, Between Two Chairs is the podcast for you. So pull up a chair and join us.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Between Two Chairs. My name is Fernando Arencibia Jr. Thank you for joining us today. And with me, as always, is the person that is working very hard to de-snarkify her comments, Jennifer Wollman. Jennifer, say hi.
Hi. I'm sorry. I'm laughing.
I took her breath
wondering,
away.
The minute that came out of my mouth, I'm like, he's going to use that against me.
I didn't. I could have said the snarky. Yes. I said, you're working on the snark. All right.
So for you, those of you who don't know me, that is a Jennifer-ism, along with Brightlineable, Jenniferism.
I love it. It's Brightlineable.
Mm-hmm. Anything that I go to has to be Brightlineable.
I love it. I'm in the same boat.
I want to take the Brightline. I want to go and experience everything the minute I step off of the beautiful Brightline station.
I'm totally with you. And it's really interesting because I'm always finding a reason to use it.
Yeah.
So I got to go up to Ocala for this district conference. I'm just going to take the train.
Brightline doesn't go to Ocala.
No, but I'll take the train. I'll rent a car. It's an hour and 20 minutes away from the station. And I'll go to my meeting, come back, and, you know, I'll be home in the afternoon.
I love to drive. I love to drive.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of times when, even though I could take Brightline, I don't. But for a lot of the stuff that we do, Brightline is just the best.
You said do.
So
I'm just throwing it out there, guys. Anyway, what a start to a wonderful podcast episode. We are going to speak about not transportation, but actually we were just diving into the first quarter financials for our commercial market update. And, you know, at first glance, it looks like it's been a really, really positive first quarter for our Southeast market, which encompasses Miami-Dade County, Broward County, and Palm Beach County. Right, Jennifer?
That's right.
Yeah. One of the things, and it's really interesting because, you know, the first thing that pops out is that we've seen a rise in sales volumes by 32% in quarter one of 2025 as compared to Q1 of 2024. And I find it really interesting because last year, being an election year, things always get a little slower during that time. People are waiting to see what are the results of the election, which way things are going to go in order to make decisions. I found that right after the election, we had a boom in activity. And there were a lot of properties that were on the market for months, and they really got put under contract between November and December. And I believe that a lot of the results of the report are a lot of those deals that got put under contract right after the election that are finally closing in Q1 of this year. What do you think?
I agree. And I love this report and I love the timing of it because we always say that, you know, markets hate uncertainty. And so after the election, there was certainty. But now because of tariffs and a lot of stuff that's going on, there's more market uncertainty. That being said, we always have to focus on what's happening locally, because the national concern and the much bigger picture concern about tariffs or about immigration or about XYZ, whatever the topic of the day is, that is the reason why not to buy real estate or why to stay on the sidelines or why not to grow my business or why not to do anything? There's always that excuse. But as we dive into the numbers, the fundamentals of why this quarter is the first quarter did extremely well and why we think the rest of the year is also going to continue along those lines is the basic fundamentals of the economy in Southeast Florida are still incredibly strong. Extremely low unemployment, great job growth, lots of businesses still coming here. Yes, not at the rate that they were during COVID. Things have started to settle down a bit, but we're still getting a lot of companies moving here. So today we're gonna do an overview of the first quarter reports. And then our next episode, we're going to interview some great, great guest speakers that are going to do a deeper dive into office space, because that's another national narrative that if you listen to the news, you're going to think one thing. And I'm seeing that with my office tenants. The smaller office tenants think that there's a ton of vacancy. How come you're not showing me more stuff? Why isn't there more stuff out there? And when you look at these reports, you'll realize that the national news does not really apply to our local real estate market.
I completely agree. So just to give you some of the rundown and the general information, so total sales volume was $2.9 billion combined between multifamily office, industrial, and the retail commercial real estate that traded in Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach County. This 32% increase year over year on Q1 was in keeping with what we saw last year, which was a 36% over the entire 2024 increase in sales volume. One of the things that I found really interesting, and to your point, there's a few things that I find interesting, but one of them is that there was a very large increase in office transactions. And I think that is because there were some deliverables that were happening in Q1, but almost $1 billion in office transactions occurred in Q1 of this year. That's a 185% increase. And I think that that has to do a lot with deliverables. Multifamily comes in second, saw the second largest increase, about a 48% increase. You know, we always speak that multifamily and industrial continue to be the places where the money is gravitating to. You have, you know, a little over $1 billion in transactions in multifamily, and then industrial had seen such an increase of volume of sales that in first quarter of 2025, we begin to see a little bit of a decrease in the number of transactions. So 32%, not necessarily the volume in as far as dollar amounts, but just the number of transactions. This seems to be a trend that we saw. Basically, even though we see a large dollar volume, we have seen a decrease in the amount of transactions. So we have less transactions. They're trading at a higher number. I think it has to do with the quality of the properties that have traded and the size of them. But, you know, we're still in a market where, you know, it's not that the inventory and the amount of sales has increased. It's just that the dollar volume, you know, people are taking advantage of the appreciation that they've gained over the last 5-10 years.
I also think it's super interesting that Broward had the largest office and multifamily deals for Q1. Oftentimes, we've spoken about how Broward sometimes seems to be the forgotten child when people are coming here to invest. They either do Miami or they do Palm Beach, and they kind of skip over Broward. So this tells me that people are looking for value and value deals, and they found value in Broward. And I love that, because as our neighbor directly to the north of us, it's got a whole different flavor and lifestyle and offerings that than we do down here in Miami. So I love seeing that they got the two largest office or the largest office and multifamily deal.
And it's really interesting, because I wonder if this is a trend that will continue. To your point, you know, Broward County landed four of the largest deals of any city in the Southeast Florida during Q1 of this year. The largest deals were two office buildings, one right on East Las Olas. Actually, both of them were in Las Olas, 410 and 350, right in Fort Lauderdale. One sold for $221 million, the other one for $208 million. Fort Lauderdale, you know, is killing it. I think one of the advantages that Broward County has is they do have a lower cost of living and working in the area. And of course, you know, for employers, it's important that there is a that lower cost of living for their employees is going to be important in their efforts to recruit and to retain the employees that they need for their industry. So I think that I think also if you look at the average asking price on the rents of office in Broward, to your point, we're going to have a great podcast with I mean, this is going to be a great interview. You cannot miss it on office here in South Florida. But, you know, one of the things that we've seen and that, you know, these individuals, you know, have alluded to us is that, you know, we're starting to see some numbers in Brickell that are just like New York. Kind of, yeah, New York rates. That's not happening in Broward. So I think that there is, don't sleep on Broward, don't sleep on Fort Lauderdale. I think those things are going to be important. And hey, I know we started, you know, we weren't not trying to connect the dots at that point, but we started talking about Brightline. But I think that the connectivity to Brightline, the ability to be there in 40 minutes with, you know, with Brightline to Fort Lauderdale, they have a great station, very centrally located. I think that that just continues to add value. So you might have some employees that live in Miami-Dade County that are going to just, you know.
I would emphasize that because I think that the Brightline, the fact that the Brightline starts in Miami and goes to Broward and goes to Palm Beach made Broward that much more attractive in terms of affordability, because now not only is it more affordable in terms of leases and in terms of housing, but you can also draw, it's mid-center, so you can draw populations from both Palm Beach and from Miami-Dade instead of having to go Miami, skip Broward, Palm Beach, or Palm Beach, skip Broward, Miami-Dade. So it gives you a bigger pool of employees, of tenants, et cetera. So I love that. And then the multifamily deals were in Pembroke Pines and Plantation, which doesn't surprise me because that's where they have some of the bigger multifamily complexes. So
I also like that if you look at the top three cities by sales volume, we already mentioned Fort Lauderdale being number one. City of Miami comes in second. So, you know, Fort Lauderdale had over $560 million in volume. City of Miami, $395. But and then the third city is Hialeah at $164 million, which again speaks to Hialeah is a very strong commercial market. There is a lot of diversity in the offerings that it provides. And, you know, it continues to be a great city to invest. So, you know, I like this breakdown. You know, we're going to put a link to this report done by the Miami Association of Realtors chief economist, Gay Cororton, which we have had the pleasure of having in our podcast. But I really like the way that this information is broken down and the fact that you could see it by county. And it's a great report. You're going to love, especially the area that breaks down the market fundamentals, because I think it'll resonate with that. One of the questions that I have for you, I'm really interested to know, how is Q2 going to look? You know, how different will it look based on the conversation that we're having about the tariffs, right? Because I kind of feel like sometimes when we look at data, especially when you're looking at the past quarter, you're looking at lagging indicators. So if I may presuppose that there were a lot of deals that were inked right after the election that were consummated in Q1 of this year, but now we are dealing with the disruption that has to do with all of the announced tariffs and the ongoing tariff conversation or tariff war, if you will. So I wonder how, if at all, that thing is going to affect the commercial marketplace and if we're going to see, you know, some distinctly different numbers.
So I think that's like a twofold question, because there's the short term, which would be Q2, and then there's the longer term effect. So that's one caveat I'm going to put in there before I do a deeper dive. And then the second one is, I think it depends on the asset class that you're looking at, right? So Miami-Dade has a lot of new multifamily that's being delivered. So that has already kind of put a stop to new housing starts for new development, right? So right. I don't think that's going to be affected by the tariffs in the short term. Those pricings are going to be more affected by vacancy rates in the short term. But in the long term, the fact that people aren't building because of the tariffs and because of the oversupply, I think eventually that's going to go back and put more strain, because even with what's currently being built on a national level, we're behind what the number of housing units that's actually needed. And we were catching up. We were delivering a lot more housing, but now we're stopping, one, because we built too much too fast, and the tariffs, right? Nobody can really quote a job or pencil something out because nobody knows where the pricing of materials is going to land. So I think in the short term, pain, but in the long term, multifamily is going to be fine, because it's going to run up to that constraint again. Yeah. I think where you're going to see more of an issue is going to be in buildings that require build out, right? Because you can't either building new buildings or building out spaces for new tenants, so office and retail space, because the cost of doing those build outs are going to be hard to predict based on where the tariffs land. So that's going to be short term pain. And I think, because again, if people aren't building or they can't, you know, most leases are going to come up with a creative workaround and more TI dollars or something is going to happen. Because if a business needs an office, they need an office, right? And our vacancy rates are super low. So I think that that's short term and is just going to take some creative financing and landlords and tenants willing to work together. I think the tariffs could affect industrial, especially here, because so much of it, so much of our logistics rely on import export. Yeah. So depending, and we're huge with Mexico and huge with Canada.
No doubt.
You know, those are some of our two biggest markets, and
Yeah.
So that could be affected. Again, short term, eventually, I think things will. But you were asking specifically about second quarter.
Sure. I think we need to be prepared for that shift. Like you said, it might be short term pain, long term gain. Hopefully that, pans out. But we all know that hoping is not a strategy, right?
That sounds familiar.
I will say that. Yeah, exactly. But I would say that when you're representing like an owner user for industrial, if that owner user is sensitive to, you know, if their business is sensitive to the tariffs, then it may affect their, you know, their acquisition power. It may affect the numbers. And so we may see some of that pan out. And I agree with you. I think industrial, you know, it's likely to be more affected from that end. However, the fundamentals are still there. It's not like we have a ton of industrial and we still have a lot of demand and a lot of pent up demand, you know? So I think that there is, you know, definitely the fundamentals are strong, but we need to continue to monitor, you know, that aspect of it. Sometimes markets move based on perception rather than reality. So we'll wait and see. It really is interesting that you bring up this idea of how creative, you know, landlords are going to be, especially for large office space that requires a lot of build out. I know that there are some cases where you have a pre-construction property and you're buying a pre-construction home and you're signing a contract. Sometimes that contract will tell you that if the cost of goods goes up by a certain amount, that then your price will also go up. So I'm really interested to see if there will be some sort of creative way of saying, well, this is the cost that we have allocated for the build out, but if as we are procuring the materials, the cost of goods goes up, then maybe there is an adjustment to the rate, maybe there's an adjustment to the term, maybe there's an adjustment to the TI allowance or removing maybe some rent abatement that you have already earned. So I think it's going to be interesting. And yeah, to your point, markets always adjust.
Right. So it's going to be really, really important to read your leases and understand your leases, because there is going to be some new wording probably put in there to address this that hasn't been contested yet, meaning nobody's taken an issue to court to see if the wording stands or not, or if the deal stands or not. So just be very, very cautious with, you know, if you're a tenant rep, with reading the leases and making sure you get an attorney to reread the lease and comment on anything. But your eyeballs always help because you're looking at it from a different perspective. And then if you're a landlord and a landlord rep, be realistic. If you have new space that hasn't been delivered yet, or you're getting ready to deliver space to a tenant, don't say I'm charging market rents and everything's a pass through. And oh, by the way, you have to build everything out at your expense, because there's no way for a business to financially quantify that because they don't know what build out's going to cost right now. So,
well, and I will say a couple of things, because I was, you know, one of the conclusions of the report is that if you look at the largest trades, they indicate that there continues to be a shift towards high quality, low risk investments. And when you're in a period of rising and economic uncertainty, then, you know, the money is going to gravitate to where there is certainty. That also means that if you have a higher risk, you know, property, right, that you're going to have to adjust your cap numbers on the sales side, because people are going to want to be compensated for taking that risk.
Correct.
Right. And as a landlord, as you mentioned, you know, when you're looking at all these things, this shift towards quality is not going to go away, especially in the office sector. But I think overall, and one of the things that I find interesting is, don't wait until, especially if you're going to lease out a space, you have a building, first time you're going to lease it out, don't wait until you secure a tenant to get numbers. You know, develop the relationship that you may have with your general contractors. Get a couple of quotes. What would be the build out on a basic build out, so that at least you have a framework of where you're starting from. Understanding that in any space that you lease out, it's going to be very customized to the tenant that you're securing. You know, and of course, institutional landlords are willing to make that investment when there is a credit tenant involved, right? And so, you know, but that's not always the case in every deal, right? And in every property, right? I think that there are a lot of inferences that you can make about what Q1 looks like that will set you up for the rest of the year, especially if you've had a property that maybe has been sitting on the market for a little bit, either because it's overpriced or because the quality is not what the market is looking for. You know, so.
Right. And that's, again, you know, those are great opportunities if you represent investors, or even if you represent the landlord, for you to get creative. Like, if that were your building, what would you put in there, or what would you do to attract tenants? Like, we have our office in Doral. It's definitely a Class A office, but it's not. It doesn't have a ton of amenities that you can get to walking. It's in Doral, but you have to get in your car to drive to downtown Doral or City Place or anything that. So I love seeing how the landlord tries to create amenities within the building. And just recently, they took a retail space that's on the ground floor level, and they made it a nice, like, eating area with tables and good lighting. And they put in nice vending machines. And I always thought, oh, vending machines, who uses them? Well, you and I, when we forget to eat lunch and it's 3:30. But I'm so pleasantly surprised that I've seen people use it for meetings or to eat their own lunch, or to bring lunch in and not be eating in the office. They have picnic tables outside underneath some trees. So if you're in one of those buildings that's not a Class A, what can you do to make it more attractive? Because Class A also has a different tenant, right? They're going to be able to pay a higher rent. Yeah. If you have a Class B building in a great area, but it might be missing something, what creative things can you do to make that building more appealing?
Sure. You know, and to do that is, you know, it's a significant investigation that you have to make, because, you know, cost of goods are going up, labor, you have to take all those things into account. But I think the biggest difference that we find in landlords that do that versus the other is you have some landlords that have a short-term horizon for that investment, and then you have landlords that have a forever, you know, horizon for that investment, right? They're going to be holders for a long time. They're going to continue to reinvest in the building to maintain its Class A approach. And it goes beyond just the quality of the building. The amenities becomes certainly a big allure You know, and sometimes, as my friend Andrew Frey did when he did his development, his Tesela development in Little Havana, sometimes the neighborhood is the amenity. So I think that's very important.
And I know you touched on this a little bit in terms of the top 10 commercial real estate in terms of sales volume, but there were some there that I was pleasantly surprised about that made the top 10. So obviously Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and Palm Beach and Miami Beach made the top 10, and Coral Gables, that's pretty typical. But then Virginia Gardens. I hadn't seen them make top 10 before. Sunrise Plantation, the only thing about Hialeah and Pembroke Pines.
Sure. The only thing about Virginia Gardens is that it may be an outlier. And the only reason I mention that is because, you know, the volume of $95 million came from one office
deal,
building,
right? Right,
on 63rd and 36th.
But that tells me something. Even though it's only one deal, the fact that that one deal was a big enough transaction land it on 10 tells me, hey, if you're looking, you might want to start looking in Virginia Gardens because somebody thought it was worthy enough of a $95 million investment.
Perfect.
So even though those other ones that we mentioned are smaller submarkets, and most of them are probably on there. I mean, Sunrise or Pembroke Pines and Plantation are probably up there because of the multifamily deals, right?
Yeah.
But somebody spent good money there, so.
Right. No, and we've heard that that airport area has continued to garner a lot of attention from the commercial real estate sector overall, but specifically in office.
Yeah.
So it's really an interesting dynamic. This is where you start to find opportunities, because I think that there are opportunities for redevelopment in Virginia Gardens. It's really interesting because you're right next to the airport. So, you know, you're going to have certain height, you know, limitations and stuff like that. But, you know,
great transportation. Yeah, a lot of multifamilies being built along the transit corridors around there. So you're going to have affordability for workforce.
Absolutely.
So these reports are always great to do a deeper dive into and start looking into something that surprised you about the market, because that's where the opportunities are. Anybody can get the data and just spew out the data. The more important thing is putting your spin on it and your take in it and seeing what gave you an aha moment, and then dig into it much deeper to find the opportunity.
Yeah, and there's an incredible diversity. Like if you're looking at the largest deals in Miami-Dade County, multifamily and Hialeah, you know what? That actually accounted for the bulk of their number, $161.8 million. It was a mixed-use project, two folios. Then you have the office building in Virginia Gardens as the next largest transaction. And then another multifamily building, this time in Aventura.
Yep.
For $82.5 million, and then an office building in Alhambra in Coral Gables for $76 million. So again, you have such a variety within the scope of these largest deals. One of the things that I really love is, so when you look at a report where the information is always in the same place, you get to look at, and these reports come out quarterly for obvious reasons, right? In commercial, you get a better sense of the market when you're looking at quarter by quarter. But it's kind of looking back at the last three reports, the last three quarters, and being able to see where are the trends, what are things that are changing, what are the things that are sticking out. Definitely, the city of Fort Lauderdale is no longer a secret based on the institutional money that has flooded in. So, you know, again, a lot of great information that you could gather from this 5-page report, you know.
And just to give you some insights, the top 10 commercial real estate sales volumes for fourth quarter of 2024, the top three were Miami, West Palm Beach, and Fort Lauderdale, whereas they got shifted around on Q1. And then Doral was on the list. They weren't on in first quarter. Boca was on the list. They weren't on in first quarter of 2025. And Hollywood was on. So again, if you go back and you see, it's kind of like the U-Haul index that Fernando and I like to talk about, where you can see different cities moving up in terms of where people are moving in from, or moving in, excuse me, to, and you get to see opportunities there. So that's about all I have for this report.
Well, that's about all I have for this report as well.
Okay.
Thank you for, you know, I think you did a great job of de-snarkifying your comments. So if I may, kudos to you. We have to encourage it. We have to encourage it.
I want to know positive reinforcement. How many people think I'm snarky other than maybe my husband.
First of all, the only person who said that you were snarky was you.
That's
you said true. That about yourself. So,
that's true. I did. I'm
like, would
I'm
never. I would never. How dare I? Well, guys, thank you again for joining us on this stat-packed podcast episode. We really appreciate your continued support. We are really blessed that we've had amazing interviews, over the course of the last year. Remember that we have a YouTube channel and that you could actually see those interviews in video format. So you could, experience them a little differently than just the audio version of the podcast. But as always, our podcasts are everywhere you get your podcast,
and
between two chairs.
And yeah. I'm pretty sure this is... Mm-hmm. The episode, I'm going to have to go back to our start day. I think we're starting season 4 with this episode.
Season 3?
No, we've already done season 3.
Okay. All right.
This is season
Listen,
4.
Listen, far be it from me to correct you, but we have a little over 100 episodes. We've done one episode.
Yeah. So then how did we break down the seasons? I'll have to see because I know we did season 3. I thought we did it by release date. I don't know.
This is far too much information.
Way too much data.
I think people are turning off right now. So,
Corinna, go ahead and edit everything before that.
yeah, edit everything out. All right, guys. Thank you again for joining us. Say bye, Jennifer.
Bye, Jennifer.